I'd like to thank Siobhan and Melanie for that very warm welcome. It's always really good to come to Bristol. And very good to see all of you. A lot of familiar faces, and it's always very good to see people that I haven't seen before. And it's just great to have a full shrine room. Just, you know, you just go and go, Namo Buddhaya, and there's that nice big sort of Namo Buddhaya sort of big voice behind you. You think, oh, this is good. So, as Kamal Jyoti mentioned, over the last quite a few weeks in this class, you've been looking at the principle of conditionality in different ways. So, I'm a sort of an appendix or an afterthought to that series, really. It's just that I was coming down now, so I thought I could do something about conditionality. And I thought it would be good to do something about conditionality in meditation, partly because that's what I've been quite busy with over the last few years, having done 3 years meditation retreat, and also because it's important, vital, that we don't just take in the idea of conditionality, but we really make it our own. We really make it how we see things, how we see life. Because it's only if we do that that we'll be in harmony with how things actually are. You know, if everything arises in dependence on conditions and we're not seeing life like that and we're operating as if it doesn't, then there will be friction between how we're seeing life and how life actually is. And that friction is what we call dukkha in Buddhism, is suffering. I'm going to start just by looking a little bit at the principle of conditionality. And I probably won't say anything that hasn't been covered in the course of the last weeks, but I suspect you probably weren't all here every week, and it's always good to have a reminder anyway. So the principle of conditionality is really central to what the Buddha saw when he gained awakening, enlightenment, by the river Naranjara 2,500 years ago. It's been central to the whole way in which Buddhism has been taught and expressed ever since. And as you'll know, the central way of expressing it is something like, all our experience comes about independence on particular conditions, and as those conditions change, so our experience changes. It's really, really simple, and you think, well, yeah, I know that, but very often we don't. If we do know it on some level, we don't apply it to our lives in all sorts of ways. So yes, everything arises in dependence on conditions, both external and internal. So for instance, what should we take? Let's take this glass of water. This glass of water arises in dependence on all sorts of conditions, direct and indirect. So maybe you could, maybe between us, we could just come up with some of the conditions that have led to us having this experience of this glass of water now. Let's make it really easy. Let's start with 50. Okay. Anyone like to suggest one? Get us started. Sila Jana. Sorry?
Rain.
Rain. Okay. Yeah, what else?
The tap worked.
Yeah.
Somebody made the glass.
Yeah. Three. Somebody put the tap in so that this rain could come out of the tap and into this glass that somebody made. Yeah.
It's made safe for drinking by filtration, sterilization,
whatever. Yep. Absolutely. Thank you.
Somebody made the metal that made the tap.
Yeah, so it's there's chains of conditions. Yeah.
You came into being.
I came into being. Am I conditioned for this?
Well, you're holding it.
Oh, I see.
You couldn't be holding it if you weren't there.
Yeah, six and a half.
You could pour it in the glass if you weren't there.
That's true. Okay, yes. Seven. Yep, what else?
Hydrogen bonded with oxygen.
Hydrogen bonded with oxygen. Yep. Okay. Eight.
Someone knew where the tap was.
Someone knew where the tap was. Yes, in fact, in this case, I knew where the tap was. Right, nine.
People gave money to put the kitchen in, put the taps in.
Yep. Ten.
Heat from the sun caused evaporation of the water.
Aha, 11.
People put the pipes underground to get the water through.
People put the pipes underground, yep, 12.
We bought this Buddhist centre.
13.
Hydrogen and oxygen had to exist in the first place.
14. So where does that lead us?
The temperature's right, so it's neither steam nor ice.
15. Good.
Sound makes up glass.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a thing as gravity, or the water was distributed everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
The Big Bang created the atoms.
Yes, absolutely. 18.
What about you had a mind that said, I'm thirsty?
Yeah. 19.
You're a human being, you know that it's water which is available to you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Monday night, we invited you.
21.
It came from a reservoir.
It came from a reservoir, 22.
There was a pipe.
There was a pipe.
There was enough water.
Yeah.
Somebody trained the plumber to fit the pipes.
Yeah. Taps. Yeah.
You have a body that needs water.
Yeah.
The plumber was born.
The plumber was born. Yeah. Yeah.
Plumbers do the food to feed people that went to making
it. Yeah, yeah. Almost anything you can think of, actually. Somebody laid the road outside so that the glass could, somebody could drive in a car and sort of put the glasses in the kitchen.
They might have cycled.
Yeah.
But they probably didn't.
But they probably didn't. Sorry?
Somebody started IKEA.
Maybe, yep. 31.
Gave the glasses to the centre.
Yep. Yep. Okay, well, you get the idea anyway. 32 ain't too bad. Yeah, and we could also do the same, play the same game with not just anything external, like a glass of water or anything you like to name. A mountain. Spinach, whatever. It's all the same principle, conditionality. And also it applies internally as well. Yeah. So the mental state that you're enjoying or not enjoying right this moment equally is a product of a whole lot of conditions. Yeah. Going back to the Big Bang from a certain point of view, because we're all affected by external conditions, but also the fact that you were born and that you learnt language and you've had a particular upbringing and so on and so forth. All these things are all bringing about this moment now. So it's important to really keep almost training yourself to think in this way. And once you've got the basic principle of conditionality, then it has all kinds of implications, which again I think you've probably been exploring over the weeks. So it has implications about what's called the middle way in Buddhism. If something arises in dependence on conditions, like this glass of water, you can't say that it's completely sort of existing by itself, because it obviously isn't. We just looked at, you know, all those conditions, which mean that it's here this moment, yeah? And it only continues to be here this moment, independent on a whole lot of conditions, like, for instance, me deciding not to throw it out the window and smash it, for one. Or, you know, there's suddenly a catastrophic increase in the air pressure or something, then it would just go... Yeah. So it's obviously not kind of inherently existent by itself, from itself, on its own terms. But also it's not completely non-existent either, because there's, you know, there's something here, and I can drink it. So each experience is supported by all those conditions. If any of the conditions that we came up with for this glass of water had been different, that experience would have been different. So it's like this moment that we're having now, for us to sit here right this moment and have this particular experience depends on a vast number of conditions. It's almost like there's a huge kind of wave of conditions. I don't know if you've ever seen paintings by there's a Japanese painter called Hokusai who does some amazing paintings of these sort of giant waves, and sometimes it's just a little boat or just a little sort of foam sort of coming off it. So this moment we're having now is just like a sort of little bit of foam that's sort of been supported by this great wave of conditions, right, going back to the Big Bang, and there it is. But then all those conditions, well, they're all in the past, they've all gone. So it's as if there's just this kind of bubble of this moment that's in a way kind of been brought into existence by all that. And it's just there, and it's changing and changing and changing all the time. And as I'm talking, moment by moment it's changing, as the conditions keep on changing. So it's quite an extraordinary kind of world that we live in. It's quite sort of magical in a way, quite amazing. Yeah. And then this moment will support, you know, it's part of the conditions for the next moment and for all the moments after that. So, you know, in our lives, you know, for better or worse, you've just heard me talk for the last 10 minutes. And, you know, that will condition everything else that ever happens to me and all of us. So, it's quite a vision, actually. So there's this whole thing about the middle way. And then there's also the fact that you can use conditionality in a way that helps and supports you, or you can work against it, as I was saying. So you can have either spiral conditionality, where your mind becomes increasingly kind of open and free and relaxed, or you can have what is called cyclic conditionality, where basically your mind sort of circles round and round and round certain kind of concerns, and it's very kind of limited in its scope. And I think you probably had a talk about the Nidana chain, the sort of links that can create that. And you've probably seen the Wheel of Life in Buddhism, which is sort of a picture of how samsara comes about, how the realms of unsatisfactoriness are brought into existence. And at the centre of that, you have a cock, a snake, and a pig. Yeah, you've seen this? Yeah. So that represents this sort of cyclic conditionality, and the pig represents a basic kind of unknowing or misunderstanding of our experience. And once you've kind of misunderstood and gone the wrong way, then this dance of the animals, this kind of really painful dance where each one is kind of biting the tail of the one in front and they're all kind of driven round, just continues and continues. So that basic misunderstanding is not seeing conditionality. It's basically seeing things in terms of fixed things. So there's a fixed me here, sort of separate from fixed you out there. And there are fixed things that I can kind of control and, you know, cling on to. And that's not seeing that everything is arising in dependence on conditions, that everything is a kind of a flow and a process. And although you can operate with it, you can never kind of fix it. And although there's a sense, yes, of me operating in the world, you can never kind of pin that down and find it. All that kind of then leads, that basic misunderstanding leads you to feel, well, yes, here am I, separate from everything else. And the pain of that then leads you to kind of want to grasp certain things and to push away other things. So you then have the cock, which represents craving, and the snake that represents aversion. And these three, once you've got that going, it just keeps on going and keeps on going, unless you really see how things are conditioned. And that takes you out of that. But as long as you have that, there's that sense of that dance of the three animals. It's driven. It's a sense of drivenness, and you can see in your own experience, and I can watch in my experience times where it feels as if I'm being driven along by life, being driven along by my craving and aversion and ignorance. And then there are other times where that isn't happening, at least to anything like the same extent, and there's a kind of an openness and a freshness to life. And my body, I can feel it in my body. If I'm driven, there's a sort of sense of my head comes forward and I'm clenching. I can feel it. But there's an alternative way of being, which is if you actually see that everything is conditioned, if you see that everything is a flow and a process, and that you're a flow and a process, so moment by moment, then you can start to relax and open into that flow, and then things start to open out, and that drivenness is no longer there in the same kind of way. That all starts to relax, and then you have this spiral conditionality where awareness of conditionality, awareness of that flow, then starts to take you along with how life is, rather than kind of against it or in friction with it. And if you go into meditation and your meditation starts to open out, you start to experience like the flow of the breath and the ease of that. So there are these two ways of operating with conditionality or against it, yeah. Understanding it or not understanding it. And in a way, all our practice is about understanding it and going with it, so that, and finding ways of developing within that. So, yeah, it's very important to be seeing life in terms of conditionality, in terms of processes and flow, and seeing how things arise in dependence on conditions. Because if we don't see it like that, then naturally we tend to live, the tendency of human beings is to live in a rather clunky, blocky world of things and people that just exist and are as they are. So that just, yeah, causes us suffering in all sorts of ways. Because if we really treat things as things and people as kind of unchanging, then when things change and people change, it shocks us. Always surprised. So We can understand this to a reasonable extent, but we need to take it really into ourselves, really into our lives, really into our bones. And that's where the whole process of reflection and meditation can help us. It's not enough just to have even kind of good ideas from the Dharma. I remember in the late 80s, I was living out in Spain in Guquiloca, one of our retreat centres, and I got news that my father had got cancer. And I'd been a Buddhist at that point for about 14, 15 years, I think. And you know, I'd studied about impermanence. But I hadn't really taken it that deep. I hadn't really kind of reflected on it, and I hadn't really meditated on it. So although I had that idea, and I could go around, you know, telling you, oh yes, everything's impermanent, and everything arises in dependence on conditions, that news, because I was very close to my father, just went straight through my good Buddhist, you know, understanding, sort of like an express train, because it just hadn't gone deep enough. Yeah. It was still somewhere, mainly on the level of ideas. So the process is to take what start out as understandings until they're things which we really know, sort of deep in our hearts, deep in our being. And you do that by living these things out in your life, but also by reflecting and meditating. So that's what we're going to be doing mainly this evening. Maybe it's worth also saying that with meditation, it's very helpful to see what happens in meditation in terms of conditionality as well. If you feel that your meditation isn't effective, then rather than deciding that you're not cut out to be a meditator, and as one can easily sometimes do, you just have to think, well, okay, in what way haven't I set up the conditions for the practice to work? So it may be that your posture is not kind of giving you much of a chance to practice. You just have to see what qualities aren't there, what's missing, and sort of bring those in. We'll explore that a bit more as we go on. Seeing things in terms of conditionality also means that your whole life conditions what happens in meditation, and meditation conditions your life. So our choices, moment by moment, it's as if we're leaving a legacy all the time to the person that we're going to become. It's like, you know, what we do now, as I say, that will subtly condition everything that happens from here on in. And it's good to be aware of that. It's like, so for instance, I'm a bit tired this evening and not as fresh as I could be talking to you, because last night I got very involved in reading something and got to bed a bit late and I didn't get enough sleep, and that, you know, the me that was reading the book didn't really kind of appreciate that they were going to leave a legacy for the me that was going to have to, you know, talk this evening to you. And so here I am, sort of a bit dopey. Just bearing in mind the fact that things arise in dependence on conditions, and that what you do now will leave a legacy for the you that's coming up, is really helpful in all sorts of ways. And in terms of meditation, it's one of the things that's really helpful is to, yes, you can work in meditation. You can think, well, have I got the right conditions to meditate? What haven't I produced? You know, could I develop a little bit more metta here so my heart was a bit more open so that the practice would go better or whatever it may be. But you can also look at your life in terms of helping your meditation practice. So, for instance, anything that your mind takes in during the day, in a way, has to be digested somewhere along the line in meditation. So, if you watch a violent movie, for instance, you probably find some of the images from that sort of popping up in your meditation the next morning. And it's incredibly difficult these days because we all have so much coming at us in life in all sorts of different ways. We're sort of bombarded with people trying to give us all kinds of information and trying to sell us anything they can. So we can still do what we can not to take in too much and at least have occasional times where we just kind of create space where we're not taking in anything. I remember years ago I'd been living at a retreat centre in Wales and I went up to London and I was sitting in a bus in Oxford Street and I felt really uncomfortable and I tried to work out why it was. And then I realised that it's like there was nowhere I could look where there wasn't stuff to read. And having been doing quite a lot of meditation, and at that point that made me quite sort of sensitive, it was as if all these things that I was reading were like people talking to me, which is what they were indirectly. So I was sitting there kind of surrounded by all these people, in the newspaper saying, oh, do you know what's just happened in Bosnia or wherever it was? And, you can't smoke on this bus and, these jeans in this shop just down here, they're only 15 quid and da-da-da. It was like I was just sort of taking in all these things. And I sometimes think that, what we take in terms of food, you can, sooner or later, you kind of see the effects of that, in terms of your waistline. If we could sort of see our kind of mental state in terms of the sort of diet that we eat mentally and that we have to digest, maybe we'd think, not sure I really wanted to take in all that stuff. Because it's quite easy to take in the sort of mental equivalent of junk food. And and all that stuff has to be processed. It has to be digested. Your mind needs a little time to take all that and digest it. So sometimes the easiest way to have a good meditation is to set up the conditions before you get anywhere near your meditation cushion by not taking in certain things so that you don't have to kind of digest them and process them when you're trying to follow the breath, say. So, yes, it's good to think in terms of setting up conditions for meditation and within meditation, looking to see whether you've got the conditions you need for the practice to be effective. Okay, yeah, I've done enough talking for now. I'd like to go a little bit further. And traditionally Buddhism talks about if you really want to take something deeply into yourself, firstly, a piece of Dharma, say, firstly you need to hear it and listen to it, so you take it in, you know what it is, but then you have to make it your own. And first you make it your own by reflecting on it, and then you make it your own by meditating on it, which really kind of takes it into the depths of your mind. So I'd like to do a little bit of both of those as we're going through the next chunk of the evening. So I'd like to do a little bit of reflection, and then we'll have a few minutes break, and then we'll do some meditation, which I'll guide you in. So reflection on conditionality involves turning over that understanding, but it's not It's not just thinking about it. And there's some people who don't get on very well, they don't like the idea of reflecting because they think, well, it's just kind of more, you know, my brain churning away. But real reflection actually involves the whole of you. It's a bit like you take the idea, to call it that, of conditionality, and you bring it in relation to the whole of yourself. So, yeah, sure, you can think about it, you can reflect, you think, okay, well, you know, as we did a little bit, yes, okay, so in order for that glass of water to be there, there's all these different things. That, in a way, we were reflecting on the glass and reflecting on conditionality. But what we really want is for it to go deeper, is to bring all of ourselves into relation with it. So as we're reflecting, sure, we can be thinking, but we can be using our imagination, which again, in a way, we were to some extent. We kind of, you know, you imagine the Big Bang just for a fraction of a second, and you imagine, you know, that person cycling to the centre with their glasses for, you know, and so on. Yeah, maybe I was imagining that kind of wave of conditions which just produced that kind of moment of, you know, that bubble of this very moment now. Yeah. So you can use your whole kind of image faculty, and then you bring your body into it too. Your body's a real source of wisdom, and as you're turning something over, you can notice your body's response to things. It's like if you're on the right track, it's almost like your body, there's a sense of an opening, often in, can be around your heart center, can be different for different people. It's like if I'm sitting in a room with somebody and they say something which feels like it's really true and they've really spoken something deeply about themselves, as if I can feel that there's a sort of downward movement of my energy. It's like something changes in my body in response to that, and I've learned to trust that. So yeah, you can sort of check in what's happening with your body as you're reflecting. And yeah, then you can also, yeah, have your emotions involved. You have your heart open to it. So as you're reflecting, yeah, you might feel excited, you might feel a bit kind of uneasy, like you're not quite sure where this is leading and you're not quite sure whether you want to go there. But you, yeah, just keep turning towards whatever you're experiencing as you're reflecting, and include the whole of yourself. So it's like you're bringing all your experience to bear, and you can bring your whole life experience to bear on things. So you can think about, yeah, if I'm thinking about impermanence and conditionality, I can think, well, yes, there was my dad, and then he did get cancer, and then he did die, and that's part of my experience too. So, and yeah, all these different things. So it's as if you bring what starts off as an abstract idea, you know, something that you can put up on a flip chart, and you turn it into something which really means something to you in your life. And, you know, something that you really test out too. Yes, it's like, to start with, when I was first getting involved with the Dharma, I felt, after a while, I felt very devoted to it, and I thought, oh, it's really beautiful. It's wonderful that that human beings have kind of discovered this path to awakening, and so I felt very devoted to it, but in a way I treated it a bit like some kind of precious vase or something that I almost didn't want to risk really testing in case it turned out, you know, not to quite be real, or, you know, I found a fault in it. And so, yes, I was very devoted to it, but I didn't really want to test it. And but then as time went on, I started thinking, well, no, you know, if the Dharma's really true, if it's really the truth of life, then it should stand up to whatever I can sort of throw at it. You know, any kind of testing I like, it should be able to withstand that. So I kind of, after one day, I sort of picked up my kind of precious vase of the Dharma, and I started, you know, trying to see whether I could smash it or not. And when I couldn't, that was when I really, you know, my confidence in it really started to grow. So reflection also involves, you know, being prepared to ask difficult questions and, yeah, really sort of think, is that right? Could it be like that? Yeah, can I find something that isn't subject to conditions? What would that be? What could that be? Just really kind of being prepared to do that. So you lay the whole thing on the line and you bring all your life experience into relationship with it. And if you find, okay, it holds firm and it holds true, then you've got something really wonderful that, you know, you've got another bit of certainty, if you like, about life. And there aren't many certainties about life other than the fact that we're going to grow old and die one day. You know, that's about all we've got that we really know for sure. And we tend to really hide away from those, which is kind of peculiar, really. The only things we know about, we tend to duck. So we're going to do some reflection, and as we do it, yeah, bring all of yourself into it. And the other thing is that if you find yourself, it's like you're thinking and reflecting, and then at a certain point it can be as if it drops onto a slightly deeper level, and it's almost as if you see the truth of it more deeply, or you kind of go, oh, it's almost as if, you know, what you knew on one level has now gone down another floor of your elevator to more into your heart, or more into your guts, even, right, into your being. So if you find that happening, don't just keep reflecting. Just sit with that experience. Just let it be there. Okay?